Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a couple of subjects in the news, which is dominated by the latest gun massacre in Aurora, Colorado. We'll begin with the survivor of the Virginia Tech massacre, Colin Goddard, who was shot four times and was one of seven in a class of 17 to survive the shooting, with three of the four bullets still in his body. We will discuss why, after Virginia Tech and the mass shooting in Arizona of a U.S. congresswoman and a federal judge, nothing was done to prevent deranged individuals from obtaining military firepower to up the ante and break records in the mass killing of innocents. Then we'll look into the role of the NRA in preventing the oversight of an industry that manufactures a product that is completely unregulated from a health and safety standpoint. Kristen Rand, the legislative director of the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., joins us. Then finally, we'll examine a new report by the Tax Justice Network that reveals the super rich are hiding $21 trillion in tax havens, the equivalent of the U.S. and Japanese economies combined. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and columnist with Reuters, David K. Johnson, joins us to discuss the scale of global tax avoidance that might be as high as $32 trillion. Joining us now is Colin Goddard, whose life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre in April of 2007, which up until a couple of days ago was the worst shooting in American history. While enrolled as a fourth-year student at Virginia Tech pursuing an international studies degree, Colin Goddard was shot four times and was one of seven out of a class of 17 to survive the shooting. He has three of the four bullets still in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. An accidental crusader against gun violence, his story is documented in the film Living for 32, and as the Assistant Director for Legislative Affairs at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington, D.C., Colin Goddard travels the country with the film and shares his story in an effort to educate, advocate, and mobilize Americans to get involved in preventing gun violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colin Goddard.
Thanks for having me.
And Colin, after what's happened in Aurora, Colorado, I don't want to depress you, but it doesn't look like it's working, does it? I mean, what more do we need to learn from these incidents? What more horrors have to visit us? I mean, the last one we had was bad enough in January 2011. A U.S. congressman barely survived being shot at point-blank range, and a federal judge was killed, along with a bunch of other innocents. I just am astounded that we keep having to have these conversations.
Well, Ian, we literally did nothing after the shooting in Tucson, Arizona last year. Nothing has changed since then, so we should not be surprised when these situations keep occurring. I mean, it is insane that someone can go into a Bass Pro Shop and walk out with an AR-15 with a 100-round drum. 8 years ago, when the assault weapons ban was still in place in federal law, you couldn't do that. You couldn't walk to the store down the road and walk out of there with a military weapon and able to fire 100 rounds before you stop and reload. No. We can change this if we want to. This does not have to be a new normal in America. If we choose to change it, if we get outraged, if we make our elected officials accountable to us,
well,
it's something that the American people are going to have to change. It's not going to come from Washington.
Well, the thing that I see on the press, though, is lots of piety, lots of platitude. We're going to work our way through it. We're going to come out stronger at the other end. But no mention about what we can do about it. And a tremendous amount of focus on the actual horror of the event itself. And you know, from the president to Mitt Romney and everybody, the word evil keeps coming up. Obviously, it may well be applied to this person. But on the other hand, there is another evil, and that is the notion that we can't do anything about a problem like this. I mean, that's unhealthy. And maybe evil's too strong a word, but it's certainly unhealthy for a nation as powerful and as innovative and that prides itself on its ability to take charge, that we as Americans are basically saying there's nothing we can do about this.
But there are things we can do. That's the thing. I mean, that's what I think is the first hurdle in this is educating people so they know that there are changes that can be made so this same situation does not happen again in another American city. You know, that's when my eyes were opened after I got shot at Virginia Tech. I mean, I was like most Americans who see these things in the news and oh my God, that's horrible, express our sympathy, you know, send our thoughts and prayers, and then ultimately we shrug our shoulders and that's it. And it wasn't until I nearly lost my life and saw in a very direct way how we have policies that allow people to walk into these public places armed to the teeth with military-grade weaponry. I mean, that's something that we can change through our public policy process. That's something that we can change when the American people get outraged. That's the bit that's been missing, is that after the sympathies are sent, the shoulders are shrugged, and that's it. There is no next step, which is what's missing, which is what has to be done differently now, is people have to get outraged, direct their attention and their focus onto their leaders, specifically on every single level. And if they want to do that, we actually are starting a new petition campaign today, petitioning each member of Congress and the president to stop arming dangerous people, to acknowledge this issue, and to find a solution. So if they visit thebradycampaign.org, they can sign up and express their outrage directly. I mean, I could think that that's the most important thing. You know, think about what happened after the Trayvon Martin shooting several months back. I mean, there was no day in court for the Martin family. That changed because Americans became outraged. You know, they signed petitions. They talked about it on Twitter. They talked about it with their friends. And the Martin family now has their day in court. That didn't come from an elected official. So they're cowards in Washington, D.C. when they stand up to the National Rifle Association. I think everyone has acknowledged that so far. So these cowards need to know that the American people are pissed and the American people want them to stand up. And when they have some backing like that, I hope, God, that this system works as it's supposed to, and they do start to stand up and they do things for our public safety.
Again, I'm speaking with Colin Goddard, whose life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre in April of 2007, which was, up until a couple of days ago, the worst shooting in American history. He was enrolled as a four-year student at Virginia Tech, pursuing an international studies degree, when Colin was shot four times and was one of seven out of a class of 17 to survive the shooting. He has three of the four bullets still in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. And of course, unfortunately, a lot of the Republican politicians, Louie Gohmert from Texas, is talking some, he's even invoking God's will involved in this, because we are, as a nation, have fallen from grace or something. I can't follow his logic there. But he also went on to say that the answer to this is to have everybody in the theater armed. It's as though if you have an epidemic of arson, then you distribute matches to everybody. It's so bizarre. But how do you know, you actually experienced a mass shooting. You were a victim of a mass shooting. The way that that's perverted by the NRA and by anti-gun control people is that they say that, you know, they appeal to the notion of how terrible it must feel to be that helpless, and therefore you have to arm yourself. Now, you obviously took a totally different lesson from what happened to you.
I mean, you have to remember that the NRA's objective at the end of the day is to have more guns sold in America. So they will do and say whatever they have to keep the profits coming in to the people who manufacture and sell guns for profit in this country. That is what the NRA's whole job is. They don't represent the average sportsman, the average hunter. They represent now the people who make and sell guns and for profit in this country. So whenever you hear someone like Louie Gohmert saying things like that, you have to remember that he's a person that takes a lot of money from the National Rifle Association and reads their talking points that they send out. You know, the idea that if we only had more guns in America, we would all be a safer place. If that idea was true, then the United States of America, the country with one gun for every human being already here, we would already be the safest place in the entire world. How many more 100 million guns do we need in this country before things become safer for everybody? That's what I don't understand.
But in terms of the film about you, the one that you've taken around the country, and again, Colin Goddard is the Assistant Director of Legislative Affairs at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Of course, the Brady Campaign began with Jim Brady being the press secretary for President Ronald Reagan. When President Ronald Reagan was the assassination attempt took place, his press secretary, Jim Brady, was grievously wounded along with the president. You've obviously taken a completely different lesson from the one that being is propagated by conservatives and by the pro-gun lobby, which is that that we can't afford to be helpless in this country. We can't afford to be victims like this. How do you combat that idea? You know, because so much of what we're being told and the testimony from the victims indicates this helplessness. And even though there were several military vets that one was serving that were shot as well, that is what, you know, the NRA, they're pretty silent, but essentially the message out there is that the only way to prevent being a victim is to pack a firearm.
It's insane. We've had presidents of this country shot, surrounded by the most highly trained armed people in this country. Right. The ultimate solution to gun violence is not more gunfire. You don't solve it with the exact same thing that's causing the problem in the first place. You know, it drives me crazy when you hear that. But people, like you said, people have come to me and said, "Wow, you know, I'm so surprised that you don't carry a gun with you now everywhere you go." I don't want to carry a gun with me where I go. I don't want to carry a gun when I have to go to the movie theater thinking about shooting someone who comes in late. I mean, that's what they're going towards. I don't want to go that way. I want to go to the way where I can go to the movie theater and not worry about that happening, or send my kids to school and not worry about that happening. You know, speak now on this or forever hold the peace is what I heard somebody say. I mean, that's what's going to have to happen. The American people are going to have to get outraged. Join us in expressing that outrage directly to those who are supposed to be voting for you. And let's have a vote on something like making sure that military weapons with 100-round drums aren't sold to the American public anymore. We did that before. We can do that again. Let's make sure we do a background check every time a gun is sold to make sure it doesn't go to someone who shouldn't have it in the first place. You know, let's improve our mental health policies. You know, there are specific things. The first is going to have to be the American people getting outraged and demanding the change. That's the part that's been missing for so long. Like I said, again, visit thebradycampaign.org today. Start this process with us. We want to take this all the way to having something change so that these same situations don't occur and we don't keep looking at each other like, oh, my God, what can we do? We can do things. We know we can do things. Now let's gather some support and go do it.
And Colin Goddard, again, his life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre in April of 2007, which was up until a few days ago the worst shooting in American history. He was enrolled as a fourth-year student in Virginia Tech pursuing an international studies degree when Colin was shot four times and was one of seven out of a class of 17 to survive the shooting. And he still has three of the four bullets in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. You mentioned Colin, the mental health aspect, there's obviously a connection here between the person who shot you at Virginia Tech and this person dressed up in this extraordinary array of military-style ballistic vests and throat guards and knee guards and shin guards and everything in the world, which apparently you can buy freely. I mean, this is stuff that only should be sold to SWAT teams, but They sold 6,000 rounds to this guy. The more you learn about him, the more you realize that he, you know, to put it mildly, has mental health issues. I guess nothing has happened since Virginia Tech, right, in terms of the nexus between, you know, mentally disturbed people and the access to firearms.
We still have millions of records, mental health records, missing from our background check system across the country. The Fixed Gun Checks Act legislation sitting in Congress now waiting for a vote would fix that, would get millions more of these records into that system so that system is running as robustly as possible, as efficient as possible. And it would also then apply that system across the board. So this person, you know, could not have just gone past the Bass Pro Shop or Grander Mountain, gone to a gun show and put money down and walked out of there without any background check. You know, I know it wasn't directly related to this particular incident that just happened on Friday, but it was to the shooting of the police officers in New Hampshire a few months ago. That was something bought without a background check. I mean, there are huge loopholes in our laws that allow dangerous people to arm themselves so easily, and we don't change them because we don't ask our elected officials to do so. We let them get bought by big business groups like the National Rifle Association and do their bidding, and we never give them crap for it. You know, that's what we need to do. That's the missing piece in all this. And if we don't fix that, we're gonna have a conversation the next time this happens, and we're gonna be looking at each other like, oh my God, what can we do? Damn it, we know what we can do already. We know how this process works. Now it just takes people getting outraged and getting it done. I don't know. I can't express that enough. I can't say it enough. I'm sick and tired of getting phone calls saying, well, is this a dead issue? What are we gonna do? How can people can't talk about this? What, we're the best country in the world. We can figure this out. You know, at least
the mayor of New York's talking about it. I mean, there is some political courage being shown, and Bloomberg is actually shaming President Obama and Mitt Romney into talking seriously about, beyond the pieties and platitudes that are coming from both of them about how we're going to work through it and how we come out stronger at the other end. And by the way, the press shares in this kind of nonsense too. They go on and on about it. They make the perfunctory reference to gun control. But, you know, I'm just astounded that we're living in an alternative universe. After the mass killing in Australia, a very conservative government there bought back all the guns and they solved the problem within weeks. Never been an incident since then.
Not on the same scale. The same thing happened in the UK after the Dunblane shooting. After the shooting in Norway with Anders Breivik, I mean, they're looking at their policies. I mean, Switzerland, a country that has a high per capita gun ownership rate, still has a huge suicide rate that they're trying to deal with. So they're looking at changing their policies so that not everyone can keep a gun and ammunition at home stored. So, you know, we're the one country that doesn't have this conversation after our big national tragedies. If it's a plane crash, if it's a mine explosion, then we look at solutions, then we look at changes. But if it involves a firearm, there's not a word. And that's our problem.
Well, just in closing, Colin Goddard, you can't help feeling, though, that there's a connection to campaign finance. Because if the NRA are able to blackmail, and they put on this absurd show the other day where, with the most brazen hypocrisy, they're the main reason why guns go into Mexico, because they refuse to allow any oversight by the ATF of these gun stores on the southern borders that supplying arms to the Mexican drug cartels. But nevertheless, they were able to put on a show and go after Eric Holder and Buffalo and blackmail a lot of the Democratic congressmen to vote to censure the Attorney General, first in the history of the United States, on this bogus Fast and Furious story. The reason that they do it is that they cave in as cowards to the NRA, is that the NRA is going to use the gun manufacturers and the ammunition manufacturers' money to knock them off in the next primary. So if you took money out of politics, wouldn't that be the way to take the power away from the NRA?
I absolutely agree. That's absolutely important to changing the discussion, not on just this issue, but on every single social issue in America right now. You know, it's unfortunately, you know, the Republicans are going to put up opposition. We can expect that. The Democrats, though, their lack of action is what's really shameful. These are the people who are supposed to be there. These are the people, you know, who know what is right to do on this, and they're not saying anything. That upsets me more than opposition or comments from somebody like Louie Gohmert. You know, the fact that we don't have our Democrats standing up here and demanding something, that's the shame. That's what we need to make right again. We need to flip that on its head again, and we want to make sure that this is something that people know, that the American people support overwhelmingly, poll after poll after poll. If you break it down to specific changes, not saying should we have more gun control or less gun control in the vague terms, but specifically, you know, should we do background checks on everybody? Vast majority of Americans say, damn yes. Should we sell military weapons to the general population and let them buy 100-round drums so they don't have to reload ever? The vast majority of the population says no. So we need to connect these dots now and get the Democrats back on board, getting them to stand up for public safety as they once championed, and then we can finally make progress on this issue again and not have these same situations occurring over and over in our country and us looking at each other like, what the hell can we do? We can do better than this. We can't accept this. This is not our new normal. We can have a better America than this.
Well, Colin Goddard, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I mean, speaking with Colin Goddard, whose life changed after surviving the Virginia Tech massacre in April of 2007, which was, up until a couple of days ago, the worst shooting in American history. While enrolled as a fourth-year student at Virginia Tech pursuing an international studies degree, Colin Goddard was shot four times and was one of seven out of a class of 17 to survive the shooting. He has three of the four bullets still in his body, as well as a titanium rod implanted in his left femur. He's an accidental crusader against gun violence. Now his story is documented in the film Living for 32, and as assistant director of legislative affairs at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington, D.C., Colin Goddard travels across the country with the film and shares his story in an effort to educate, advocate, and mobilize Americans to get involved in preventing gun violence. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Kristen Rand, the head of the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Is a warm gun. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. When I hold you in my arms and I feel my finger on your trigger, I know nobody can do me no harm. Because welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kristen Rand, who's an attorney and the legislative director for the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., a national nonprofit organization working to stop gun violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Rand.
Thank you very much for having me.
And since the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, all we're hearing from the media and from our politicians are platitudes and piety and lots of talk about getting through this, getting past this, coming out stronger at the other end, but no mention of what to do about it. Is there some weird disconnect here in our country where there are certain things that we simply can't deal with, even though they're staring us in the face?
Well, I think there's a great hesitancy among policymakers, particularly at the federal level, to talk about gun control out of sheer fear of the National Rifle Association. And I think the average person in America does make the connection and does see how outrageous it is that we have assault weapons and 100-round magazines like those used by the shooter available to civilians readily. I think the average person thinks that's outrageous, but it's the policymakers who can't make that connection.
Or presumably don't want to. I mean, the mayor of New York is trying to shame both presidential candidates. He said on the radio program, Mayor Bloomberg, that maybe it's time for the two people who want to be president of the United States to stand up and tell us what they're going to do about this, because this is obviously a problem across the country. Now, the president is going to Aurora, Colorado on Sunday. So this is clearly an area, again, that can't be discussed by politicians. If the citizens can talk about it, why not the politicians? I guess the answer comes back to the NRA.
Yes, well, Mayor Bloomberg is absolutely right, and I think he described exactly the problem, that we have these assault weapons freely available. We have firepower available to civilians that far outstrips that which is used by your average police department, and this is the natural result. And this will not be the last shooting. We will face this again in a short period of time. And it is incumbent on the President of the United States to stand up and say the value of American lives is greater than the wants of the gun lobby. And we certainly agree with Mayor Bloomberg on that. And you have a lot of politicians in California who have been leaders on this issue. Senator Feinstein has been at the forefront of trying to ban assault weapons for decades. And she deserves a great credit for that. California is actually a great example of a state that stood up to the gun lobby in the wake of similar mass shootings and said enough is enough. and you've addressed the problem effectively. And we can do that nationally if we have the will and the leadership from President Obama.
But at this point, and usually when these massacres happen, and they do happen with a grim frequency here in the country, and of course it's almost a year to the date from the massacre in Norway, which was a very unexpected case in terms of that particular country. Regrettably, people, I imagine, don't think it's totally surprising here in the United States. I recall some time ago in Australia, there was a mass killing with assault rifles, and immediately the government, which was a conservative government, basically did a buyback of all guns, long rifles and assault weapons and handguns. And there's never been an incident since. So there is a fundamental difference here, and I guess I don't want to be a broken record, but it comes back to the NRA.
Yes, it all does come back to the NRA, and America should be looking to other countries who've successfully dealt with this issue. Australia, the United Kingdom, both reacted very aggressively in the wake of similar mass shootings and have not experienced similar events since. And I think you bring up Norway. That's a very important example. That shooter got his weaponry in America. He sought out a Mini 14 assault rifle that's very similar to the one used by the shooter in Colorado because it was the most military-style weapon available. That gun was made in America and through a loophole available in Norway. He ordered his high-capacity ammunition magazines from the United States. So we see in other countries that do put a high value on human life and do take steps to prevent this, that shooters come to the U.S. to arm themselves. And we have to stop this, or we're going to see many, many, many more Colorados in the near future.
Well, ironically, when the U.S. Invaded Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks, in the material that they captured from Al-Qaeda, they discovered the Al-Qaeda handbook, and in the Al-Qaeda handbook, jihadis were advised not to bring weapons into the United States. If they wanted to do damage in the United States, all they had to do was purchase the weapons in the United States. So even Al-Qaeda is aware of the availability of guns here in the United States. Again, I'm speaking with Kristen Rand, who's an attorney and legislative director for the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., a national nonprofit organization working to stop gun violence. You make the point, which I think is very, very logical, that firearms are consumer products, and if an airplane crash or the major car crash or food were poisoned, people would immediately be, getting the government, the oversight parts of the government, to address these problems. So you're saying that this is not politics, it's public health, that you have an industry that manufactures a product that's completely unregulated from a health and safety standpoint.
That's exactly right. Firearms are the last consumer product manufactured in America, not subject to federal health and safety regulation. And that's why we have an industry that's become so highly militarized and sells the assault weapons and the high-capacity ammunition magazines used inevitably by every mass shooter, going back to the McDonald's massacre in San Ysidro, California in the early 80s. We have an out-of-control gun industry, and it's the direct result of the power of the gun lobby in keeping that industry exempt from federal health and safety regulation.
And that's the point to make, isn't it, that the NRA is not some Second Amendment freedom operation that's trying to preserve the Constitution, as they do wrap themselves in the flag and continually refer to our freedoms and our Second Amendment rights. But the bottom line is that they are just simply a lobbying group for gun and ammunition manufacturers. And that's where they get their money from. And the money that they get from the gun makers to make guns so accessible is the money that they use to effectively blackmail politicians with the threat that if you don't go along with us, we'll run somebody against you in the next primary.
Well, that's exactly right. The NRA has become nothing more than a shill for the gun industry. They get direct contributions from many of the major gun manufacturers. One of their greatest benefactors is a man who made a fortune off selling ammunition over the internet, like the 6,000 rounds of ammunition that the shooter in Colorado apparently purchased. The NRA's agenda is built around pushing through policies that will sell more guns. And they're more and more desperate to do it because actually personal gun ownership in America is on the decline. So what they're desperately trying to do is sell another gun to someone who probably already owns 10 or 12 other guns. So they have to make the more militarized, more lethal, because they have to keep lining the pockets of the gun industry.
So why then is there any traction in this freedom argument? I mean, why do people have to have personal arsenals as a sort of exemplify their freedom? I don't understand culturally what this means to equate freedom with unlimited firepower.
Well, there's a small minority of Americans whose basically entire lives revolves around guns. And I can't really explain it to you, but it's a very strong culture. And, you know, there are many people who spend all of their time pushing policymakers to weaken gun laws because they see it as some sort of icon of personal freedom. It's a very, very, very small minority of Americans, but they're the ones who constantly communicate to their policymakers at the local, state, and federal level. And I would say to your listeners, if you're sick and tired of this, of these mass shootings, pick up the phone and call your legislator. And it doesn't matter if they're already, you know, good on the gun issue, like Senator Feinstein. People like her need support from people who say enough is enough. And if people who are tired don't start speaking out, this small minority of people obsessed with their guns will continue to control the debate and control public policy and ensure that we see more and more incidents like Colorado in the near future.
But even the people with these arsenals at home, nobody's planning on taking their guns away, even though there's a certain absurdity there. I'm wondering, though, since I'm talking to you from Hollywood, California, across the street from Universal Studios, and as you know, movies and movie posters and television shows invariably have the main characters pointing a gun at you or at the audience, whether they're some wispy little blonde who plays an FBI agent or one of the male leads in the so-called A-list male leads in the bigger movies. The long and the short of it is that I don't understand the cultural connection here between guns and heroism. In other cultures, for example, in Australia, if you were to pull a gun out in a fight, you would be looked upon as a lowly coward, as being despicable, or probably even worse if you pulled a knife. I mean, you know, manly men use their fists, that kind of notion. Why is it in America that we connect guns with heroism instead of with cowardice?
Well, I think it's really a result of the job that the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers have done of selling this idea that guns are equal to freedom. I mean, it's just a really decades-long campaign, and again, that is bought into by a very small minority of Americans. I don't think most Americans see it that way, but a small vocal minority does. And, you know, we do need to start changing the culture, but I don't think the problem is guns and movies, because people across the world see movies made in America and don't lash out the way this man did in Colorado. So we say, let's put the focus on real guns, not on guns in the movie. And there is a cultural aspect to this. There is a sick gun culture out there that glorifies these military-style weapons. and people who are completely obsessed with them, and that is a part of the problem. But the bigger problem is that our leaders will not say no to those people, will not say, you do not need to own an assault weapon. You do not need a 100-round high-capacity ammunition magazine. There's a point at which it's too much of a threat to public safety. You can have your sporting shotguns and rifles, as you pointed out earlier. No one's going to, quote-unquote, take anyone's guns away. We just want to limit the firepower that's available on the civilian market. I think it's very important to point out that the shooter in Colorado recently bought these guns. They're new guns. It's a new assault rifle he used. It's a new high-capacity ammunition magazine. We have to start now to ratchet back this level of firepower and begin to reduce the likelihood that these events will happen in the future.
Well, just in closing, Kristen Rand, the NRA has been very effective, as we've mentioned, in basically cowering the Congress into submission. They had this totally fraudulent Fast and Furious issue that they pumped up, which was the height of brazen hypocrisy, because the NRA is the reason why these gun stores on the southern border have no oversight and no restrictions in selling unlimited amounts of heavy firepower to the Mexican drug cartels. They're the problem, but they managed to, through their political muscle, and to intimidate a bunch of Republicans into voting for this bogus contempt vote against Eric Holder, which again was just surreal, given the role of the NRA and the Tihard Amendment, which prevents any sharing of information amongst law enforcement in this country for guns that are caught at crime scenes, guns that have actually been used to kill people. There's a blackout of information. It's just surreal to recognize the insanity of the laws that they managed to pass and the despicable, cowardly nature of the Congress. But I imagine it all comes down to campaign finance, doesn't it? If you take them, the only way to stop this extortion against the Congress is which is via the money that they threaten the congressman with, is to take the money out of politics. I can't think of any other way to do it.
Yes, campaign finance reform is incredibly important, not just for gun violence prevention, but for every other progressive issue, climate change, food safety. I mean, you can go down the list of things that are important to people in their daily lives, and the campaign finance system has an adverse effect on that system. And actually, just recently, the Senate voted on the Disclose Act, which would have required people, organizations who engage in electoral activity and run ads like the NRA, to disclose exactly where that money's coming from. For example, if the NRA were using gun industry money in attack ads, they would have to disclose that. And the NRA took a big role in killing that bill in the Senate. So you are absolutely right. We need campaign finance reform. But, you know, the other part of why the NRA is so effective is their grassroots. Again, the people who are just obsessed with their guns and who sit, you know, by their computers waiting for the instructions on who to call, when to call, and are in constant contact with their state and federal legislators. And we need some people who care about gun violence prevention to take the time out of their day to call their legislators, and now is a really important time to do this. And again, California is a perfect example of a state that stood up to the gun lobby, has very strong gun laws, and has seen a very significant decline in gun death over the past couple decades because they were strong enough to stand up to the gun lobby. And we hope that they will be a model for the nation as we move forward in the wake of this horrendous shooting in Colorado.
Well, Kristen Rand, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kristen Rand, who's an attorney and legislative director for the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., a national nonprofit organization working to stop gun violence. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the super rich are hiding $21 trillion of their treasure around the world.
be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, a columnist for Reuters and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for enterprise reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he's uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, will be published in September. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me on again.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And just to change the subject from Aurora to what people were talking about before this incident, and obviously Mitt Romney in his tax situation, the extent to which he's apparently playing pretty hardball in not wanting to release his tax forms, and joining this debate or throwing fuel on the fire, if you will, is a new report by the Tax Justice Network, written by James Henry, a former chief economist with a consultancy firm McKinsey, that now has revealed that the super rich have hidden at least $21 trillion in tax havens, a figure equivalent to the size of the U.S. and Japanese economies combined. Does that strike you as extraordinary?
Well, it's the best estimate anybody has been able to produce yet. James Henry, who is extraordinarily skilled at looking at the fine print to figure these sorts of things out, went through various disclosure statements of the big private banks. And this figure he's got, $21 trillion, is roughly 10% of the value of the net worth of the planet. That is, the best latest estimates of the planet's net worth is around $210 to $250 trillion. So I think it's entirely credible that, yes, we could have 10% of the world wealth in these places. And he also estimates that about 92,000 people have almost $10 trillion, that's their personal money. This isn't corporate money, it's their personal money. That's an average of a little over $100 million each.
Well, he also says that the $21 trillion figure may actually be a conservative figure, and the true scale could be as high as $32
trillion. Yes, he does, which would bring it up to about 15%. But, you know, $21 trillion is big enough to make the point that there is this enormous amount of secretive money, the gains on which are either being tax-deferred or not taxed at all. If you assume that the people holding, the 92,000 people holding private accounts are just making 5% of their money, and I'm being cautious there, 5% is what you ought to be able to earn if you're sophisticated over time without much difficulty, then you're talking about $5 million a year to each of those people, probably going untaxed and compounding. And, of course, this is one of the reasons that I've said that I believe that the Cayman Islands, as currently operated, are a threat to the national security of the United States, because the revenue that is lost through these devices to the United States government and to other modern countries, Europe, Japan, Canada, is very, very damaging to them.
Well, the data that Mr. Henry used comes from the Bank of International Settlements, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and from national governments.
It seems, though, as bad as it is for the United States to have all of this money, one, sitting idle and not doing anything, and two, avoiding taxation, it seems that, though, the worst hit are the 139 developing countries where since the 1970s, the richest citizens of these 139 developing countries have amassed $7.3 trillion to $9.3 trillion of unrecorded offshore wealth. And this is a...
Right. Well, in many cases, those are countries that are essentially run by kleptocrats who are looting the public good, you know, and looting the public bank in order to do this and causing terrible damage. There's one problem. I talked to James Henry today about this to make sure. There is one problem with this data, and that's something called round tripping. We don't know how much of this money is really... circular in its flow. For example, if you look at the direct foreign investment in India, the Indian government has concluded that it's not a real number and that a good deal of that money, possibly as much as half, is money that leaves India, is sent to places like Mauritius, the sugar islands off the east coast of Africa, and then reinvested in India. This appears to be going on in China at a tremendous rate of people removing money and putting it back. The growth of that has stopped for the moment because of the world economy. But this general trend is there. So the picture is a little complex, Ian, but nonetheless, it should be a major public policy concern that 10% or more of the world's wealth is being held in countries whose basic business is helping people evade taxes.
And this is described by Mr. Henry as a huge black hole in the world economy. It seems like a pretty apt description.
It retards overall growth for everybody. And, of course, the world is full of stories of people who get into these deals with the private bankers. If they have done anything improper, the bankers are now in control of them. You've put your money with these private bankers, and you want to take it out. And they go, well, no, you can't do that. And if you do, they imply that they will tell the tax authorities in your home country about this. And you might be earning higher returns, making the economy better, if you had left the money in your country in the first place. And the world is full of examples of wealthy people who, in order to avoid a dollar of tax, lost $20 of the value of their wealth. Which is part of why it's important that we get to the insanity of this notion that the thing that drives business is avoiding taxes. It's not. It's making profits and maximizing wealth.
Again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnson, the columnist with Reuters and the president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times, where he won the Pulitzer in 2001. And he's been so successful in uncovering tax dodges, he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. He's also written the bestsellers Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest book, coming out soon, is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. At the end of 2010, the 50 leading private banks alone collectively managed more than $12.1 trillion in cross-border investment assets for private clients. And the three private banks handling the most assets offshore are UBS, Credit Suisse, and Goldman Sachs. And there are less than 100,000 people, you mentioned 90,000 people worldwide, who own about $9.8 trillion of the wealth held offshore. This, of course, is coming into focus a little thanks to Mitt Romney. Do you think this story with Mitt Romney, now that's off the headlines because of the latest massacre, is it going to come back, do you think, David K. Johnson?
Oh, yeah. I think that the Obama administration, or Obama campaign, I'm sorry, not the administration, the Obama campaign, they're going to torture Romney with this all the way up to the election. Romney has been very clear that he will not release more returns. I've talked to the campaign. They're quite insistent about this. And so in line with that, there's an ad that the Obama campaign put out that I think is very, very pregnant with meaning. It pokes at Romney for his offshore accounts and his very low tax rate, and then says, why won't you release your returns? Could it be you didn't pay taxes in some years? Now, remember, Romney gave 23 years of returns to the McCain campaign 4 years ago when they were considering him for vice president, and he was passed over for that very deep thinker and well-known leader, Sarah Palin. which makes one wonder, was there something in those returns that was troubling beyond the fact that it would just be two rich white guys running for president? Secondly, the Romney people, when asked if he's paid taxes, have said yes. The problem is journalists didn't ask the right question. The question is, did you pay federal income taxes every year, and did you pay a relatively nominal amount in any year, say less than 5% of your income? This ad that says, didn't you pay any, I don't believe, based on what we've seen of Obama, who is a cautious but decisive man, that they would have run that ad unless they know somehow that he's got a year where he paid no or virtually no taxes. And I point to the example of how the Obama administration killed Osama bin Laden. He demanded that they very carefully plan this. It wasn't like the Jimmy Carter 1979 disaster in the desert over the hostages in Iran. But when the time came to make the decision, he did it. And I just can't imagine that Obama, who personally had to approve that ad, would have had that phrase in there unless they know he's not going to release his returns, because doing so would be more damaging than not releasing the returns.
And the fact that he gave 21 years to John McCain when he was hoping to be the VP indicates that they exist. I mean,
there are other reasons that things like this get out there. All rich people, Ian, are involved in various kinds of litigation, disclosure statements, all sorts of things could have happened. You know, 22 years ago, I guess, I broke the story that Donald Trump, who was claiming to be a multibillionaire, actually had a negative net worth because somebody gave me his net worth statement prepared by his bankers.
Well,
it was a low-level person who, you know, leaked it out to me. And so, shouldn't be the least bit surprising if the campaign has gotten a hold of either the actual returns or the what are called the abstracts of them.
So it's just as well that Donald Trump has a day job being a vulgarian on television, right?
Yes. Well, of course, earlier this year, all sorts of journalists, you know, including my former employer, the New York Times, and my former employer, the LA Times, were treating is him seriously as a candidate for president of the United States. And in fact, all he was doing was running for a better contract on television. After all, realize that he had to say, I'm sorry, I just can't serve as president because I've got something more important to do. I've got to have my TV show, The Apprentice. Yeah, right.
Well, David K. Johnson, there are things that are going on in this country, particularly in how it impacts the democracy and how facile and almost futile the national debate is. For example, if you're a registered eligible voter who votes Democrat, you have to jump through hoops and you have to prove who you are. But if you're a billionaire who's buying the election for the Republicans, you don't have to reveal who you are. And if you're president of the United, running for president of the United States, and basically saying you'll run America like a good manager, and you'll be the CEO of USA Incorporated, and if you're in charge of USA Incorporated, and you're Mitt Romney, if you're a businessman, then you got to look at the revenue side. Where do you get your revenues from to run USA Incorporated? Well, the revenues come from taxes, for God's sake. And, you know, you're saying that you're not required to let the American people know what your policy and preferences and practices are vis-a-vis taxes. This is
we do know, Ian, his broad outline. Basically, Romney believes that wealthy people should pay some taxes, but they should pay much lower taxes than they do now. I mean, that's what we fundamentally know. And there's a lie that has enabled him to get away with this. Today, somebody posted about me, you know, the same lie that you see everywhere. Everybody I've ever talked to who relies heavily on Fox News believe this. That is this idea that after the taxes were cut in 2001 and 2003 under President Bush, that revenues rose. They didn't. They didn't. They never got back to the level of 2000 and 2001. And 2001 was a recession year, the year the Bush tax cuts the first tax cuts took effect. That since then, in both real terms and especially in per capita terms, revenue has fallen. The individual income tax now brings in round numbers, one third less per American than it did in 2001. how are you supposed to run a country with the growing complexity in the world, with as a result of the way that the U.S. responded to 9/11, the increased military spending, with one-third less revenue from your largest single revenue source? It's crazy.
Well, he's also going to cut taxes, and the Ryan plan, which he endorses, will mean...
Yes, and let me just... One part of the Ryan plan. Let me just take one part. You know, Paul Ryan, who is treated as if he actually is a serious person in Washington, because most journalists just know how to report what's said. They accurately report what people tell them, but they don't really understand the underlying meaning. He has a plan to turn Medicare into a plan that would have a defined contribution to it, not a defined benefit. And he says that if we do that over the next 75 years, it will save so much money that your taxes will go down by the equivalent of $5.7 trillion today. Now, that's a lot of money. That's the entire output of the American economy from New Year's Day well into May. Here's what he doesn't tell you. His plan would raise private spending by $40 trillion. So you'd save $1 in taxes and spend $8 out of pocket, unless you're poor, and then you just die. What kind of bargain is it for you to save you a dollar in taxes and spend $8 more somewhere else? I mean, that isn't voodoo economics. That's insane economics. And yet, as best I can tell, I'm the only journalist who's pointed this out in the whole country. This should have been big news. And by the way, the numbers I'm giving you, the $40 trillion, they come from using the exact same technique that was used by Ryan's staff to come up with their figure and just applying it to private spending.
So
it's the exact same technique. There's no complexity or anything else. It's just, okay, you did it this way. Now let's do it to the other side of the equation, private health care spending. 8-1. You'll end up with a $7 net loss, and he's treated in Washington as a serious person?
Well, just in the last minute here, David K. Johnson, apparently the polls are pretty even. So I'm just not wondering. I'm wondering why the average American taxpayer is not outraged at how they're shouldering the burden, and people like Mitt Romney aren't.
Because with America, we don't raise people to be critical thinkers. We know from a study done by Fairley Dickinson that people who get their news primarily from Fox are less well-informed than people who say they have no regular news source. You know, they hear things on the radio and they walk by or whatever. Those people are better informed. We have a nation of people who are innumerates. You know, just like there's illiteracy, there's innumeracy, people
right.
who don't really understand numbers.
Right.
And it is a major problem. And it isn't just a problem with policy. It's a problem that's making us poorer relative to the rest of the world.
Well, David, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, a columnist with Reuters and president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, and he's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times, won the Pulitzer in 2001, and is the author of Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal, and his latest coming out soon is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.